You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with professor, researcher, and author Sven Nyholm. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I think we're betting on AI as something that can help to solve a lot of problems for us. It's the future, we think, whether it's producing text or art or doing medical research or planning our lives for us, etc. The bet is that AI is going to be great, that it's going to get us everything we want, so to speak, and make everything better. But at the same time, we're gambling with, at the extreme end, with the future of humanity. I mean, there are those, including very successful AI researchers such as Geoffrey Hinton, just recently got a Nobel Prize for his work in AI, who I seriously worry that AI can have disastrous consequences, that we're going to lose control over AI and that we may end up harming ourselves in the process. Less perhaps dramatic versions of that relates to what you mentioned, namely these enormous data centers that use up so much energy, that use so much water to cool down these very hot computer systems. The natural resources that are needed to build all this technology that maybe are not replenished as quickly as they're used up, so to speak. When we're betting on AI being good and important enough that it's going to be worth it, so to speak, that we're not doing a bad gamble. Where are we going to go in the future? Well, it's hard to predict. We're seeing a lot of, every now and then, these sort of quick developments where things seem to just take off. For example, with the release of ChatGPT and other large language model-based chatbots and other forms of generative AI, suddenly there appeared, at least to the general public, to be an enormous leap forward. The question is, going to continue in an equally rapid way into the future? And if so, are we steering the ship, so to speak, in a safe and careful way? Or are we being reckless? Are we driving the car, so to speak, while blindfolded and while drunk and intoxicated with the idea of getting to where we want to go? Or are we driving in a careful and slow way, buckled up and, you know, taking all the precautions? Probably somewhere in between those two. Even the big tech companies have people working on what they call AI safety. And the big tech companies also hire colleagues of mine to work on ethics and AI. So there are attempts to put up safety risk mitigation measures, guardrails, etc. But we're sort of pushing ahead as quickly as possible and gambling with the future of our society, with stability, etc., hoping for the best and hoping that this, what I'm calling the AI wager, is going to work out to our advantage. But we'll see. It was very striking that when Trump was inaugurated as president, the most well-known figures from the tech industry were also there in the room, sometimes taking more prominent seats in the inauguration ceremony than some of the members of the cabinet. And normally one would have think would have sort of sat closest to the president when he was inaugurated as the new president. And you talk about donations and indeed, and people in the tech world influencing governments. It's not only the American government, other governments too are being courted by the tech industry, who are hoping to relax regulations perhaps, or maybe hoping for there to be regulations that fit with their ends and goals, etc. So you were asking, what can we do over here in the European Union or in Europe to counteract this? There's something called the Brussels effect one sometimes talks about. The EU is trying to create all sorts of regulations and hoping that, even though the US and China are perhaps the two most advanced AI powers in terms of the technology development, a lot of people here in the European Union and Europe in general are hoping that we can sort of be the forerunners when it comes to responsible AI and incorporating AI into society in a kind of responsible way. Certainly the GDPR that had influence outside of Europe, the EU AI Act you mentioned, that is also something that we're hoping will inspire different parts of the world to adopt similar guidelines. To just mention the Chinese case, I mean, they are also working a lot on AI ethics and AI guidelines. You mentioned that values differ in different parts of the world. I would say yes and no. Actually, if you look at some of the AI ethics guidelines that are formulated in the Chinese context, there's a lot of overlap with what you would expect in the European context. Some colleagues of mine looked at, I believe, 80 or 90 or something like that, AI ethics guidelines from all sorts of different organizations, governmental or organizations of other kinds, research institutions, government organizations, and private entities. A lot of the general principles that are formulated will sound quite similar, and we can all kind of agree on them. A lot of the disagreement, I think, when it comes to AI ethics and AI guidelines and policy, etc., comes to how do you sort of put this into practice, and how do you interpret values such as, let's say, freedom or equality And also, how do you balance these values? I mean, how much, let's say, inequality are you willing to tolerate in order to have more freedom, to innovate, to experiment? Or the other way around, how important is it to give everyone a voice and create a democratic process? Well, if that's the aim, then perhaps the tech industry has to, you know, not get too much space to operate in an unconstrained sort of way. So we're hoping to set a good example with good and well-formulated and well-thought-out rules and regulations, legal and ethical frameworks. Of course, there's a discussion on an abstract level. As I said, we can perhaps all agree to some extent on certain values and certain ethical principles. I mean, who is against human dignity? Who is against promoting people's welfare? And who wants to impose suffering on others sort of unnecessarily, etc.? It's going to be hard to find people who say that, yeah, I'm completely opposed to all of those values. But when it comes to sort of putting this into practice, asking what it actually means, to what extent can we force either users of AI, regular people, or the tech companies developing the technologies, to what extent can we control the business model, et cetera? There you're going to have a lot of disagreement. And also, are we ultimately looking to use AI in our everyday life to do things such as making shopping lists or making purchases online or having a chatbot companion or perhaps even a chatbot therapist, et cetera? Or are we ultimately aiming for a societal scale, let's say military uses of AI, for example? I'm from Sweden. We recently had a minor scandal where our prime minister had been discussing policy issues with one of the chatbots and to come up with ideas. And this came out and people said, we didn't vote for, let's say, ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini, whatever it was. We voted for this person to represent us and we want our elected representatives and not AI chatbots to come up with ideas for policy making and decision making. Basically, small AI companies can usually not create something that is going to be equally sort of impressive as, let's say, ChatGPT or Gemini from Google. Those things are very, very expensive to create, to run, and to operate. Small AI companies are going to have trouble matching that in terms of the quality of the product that they can put out. And at the same time, small companies, let's say OpenAI at the beginning, before they acquired some of their wealth and success, etc., they may have started out in one way. As you say, they have certain philosophies about everything should be. Try to be cautiously optimistic about AI. I don't think that for any possible problem, AI is always going to be the solution. I think that there's a sort of subset of the problems and the challenges that we're facing, for which indeed it might be the case that certain kinds of AI or other technologies are going to help us to solve these problems. But there are also other parts of life, whether it's personal relationships, whether it's life and death decisions, whether it is learning different types of skills, writing, critical thinking. I'm a professor of philosophy at the university. This is what we teach our students. Where I think that AI is not necessarily always going to be the best means to the end. And so obviously, if instead of thinking critically yourself, you're asking an AI chatbot or an AI model of some sort to think for you, to solve the problem for you, then you're going to get less practice and experience with critical thinking. I mean, most skills, whether it's learning the violin, and you know, my wife is a professional violinist at a very high level. She has to still have to practice several hours every day to keep up her skill and develop over time, etc. In the same way, I mean, if you want to learn critical thinking, if you want to learn how to have good relationships with other people, there are these things that AI may possibly help you with, but you have to put in a lot of effort, a lot of hard work. And you can't be lazy. But the sort of the promise of a lot of AI, and you mentioned this idea that instead of writing a book, I mean, I've by now written 4 books and it's a lot of hard work and a lot of efforts. With my book that's about to come out, I'm sitting now and working on an index and I'm also proofreading. I have the proofs of the book that I'm going through and it's all of this is painstaking. And then, of course, the writing itself, the research, etc. It could be very tempting if you go on Amazon and other places. There are lots of these books that say, you know, how to write a book and make a lot of money without having to actually write anything, so to speak, or how to create or generate a book because AI can do it for you. That could be tempting. And so people have this tendency, they want other people to sort of recognize them and to applaud them and to say, well done. But they're also worried about having to put in the hard work and the effort. Wouldn't it be nice if we can somehow get the benefits and the rewards without having to put in the hard work? And then also perhaps avoid accountability if something goes wrong. We can say, no, it wasn't my fault. AI did it. I think the problem is that to actually deserve credit for something such as a book or for, you know, playing an instrument or producing some sort of content, normally we think that Well, effort is one thing. If there's no effort involved, then why should we give you any kind of credit or recognize you as having done something good? If there's no need for you to show any special talent or skill, then why are we applauding you? If you can be totally passive, you press a button and out comes something and then you put your name on it. Well, in those kinds of cases, one doesn't really seem to deserve much credit. People who do deserve credit are people who have worked hard to develop certain skills, who have honed their talents and skills, who make an active contribution to something good, where the good thing is not just a merely happy accident or side effect. That's not the sort of thing that we think is praiseworthy or where people deserve credit and they show that they have merited some good response. But AI seems to go in exactly that direction. We hand over tasks to something else, to someone else, a chatbot, an AI system. We don't have to do the work. We don't even have to have the talent because AI has been trained on the talents of other people to produce good outputs. You just have to put your name on there. I mean, I should say that while it's an interesting idea that AI can be compared to human intuition, I would say one thing that constitutes human intuition, we have different types of intuitive thinking. For example, as we're moving about the world, we have physical intuition, so to speak, about how we can move our bodies. You know, if someone throws a ball our way, we can catch it sometimes without thinking because we have a sort of intuitive sense of where it's going to be. People who do sports, they practice so that they develop those kinds of intuitions. If someone who's a basketball player or a tennis player, the way that they interact with sort of balls flying around is different from you and I, assuming that you're not a professional tennis or a baseball player, because we haven't practiced to improve our intuition in that domain. Someone like yourself who is interested in art creation, as you practice, or let's say my wife with the violin, people develop enhanced intuitions within the domains where they do their work. There's something that you have to learn. So once you've learned the skill, you can do it kind of what seems to you almost automatically. It's a sort of internalized skill that you can. I mean, I have one of my former teachers, Peter Railton at the University of Michigan, he talked about what he called fluent sort of agency. We become fluent in tennis playing or in art creation, etc. Just as you're learning a new language, you have to really struggle at the beginning, but then eventually you start becoming fluent in the language. Then, of course, there are also other kinds of intuitions, let's say a moral intuition or ethical intuition. So when you're presented with a sort of moral dilemma, then sometimes you can't really say why, but you think that it would be wrong to, let's say, kill someone in order to save some other person. Or sometimes you have the intuition that it would be right to sacrifice one person to save two others or something like that. And these kinds of intuitions we also have. Now you can reproduce patterns in AI systems that would sort of roughly match up with these intuitions. Like, for example, for the reason that so much of our writing expresses moral opinions that a lot of people share, there will be patterns in text that can be found in books and online that would sort of, a pattern identifying machine would be able to tell what our moral intuitions are. But it's because those are reflected in the text outputs. It's not because that AI systems would also develop human moral intuition. Again, here there are different theories. There are people who say that moral intuitions are more emotional. There are others who say that they're partly emotional, partly intellectual. But intuition is a diverse phenomena with different aspects to it. I think one thing to keep in mind is that having a what you might call a rich life, not in the sense of having a lot of money. Of course, people who have a lot of money may have, in certain respects, fewer problems than other people, but they have also other problems. But rich in the sense of variation, being able to enjoy culture, muse. I mean, I talked about violin playing, my wife being a violinist at a very high level. If you go to classical music or jazz or whatever it might be, concert, and not just listening to it on YouTube. If you're a student, you're asking what can students learn, participating in university life. Most universities and other similar kinds of institutions, you know, it's not only the classes that are offered and the degrees that you get on at the end of these studies. I mean, there are also all sorts of activities. You can get involved, volunteer, you can go to your different kinds of talks and presentations and cultural. And so to think that there's a lot of variety to life. And if you just sit all day watching, let's say, TikTok videos, and you have a very limited amount of activities, and a lot of them are activities where you're very passive, you're taking in information, you're not actively learning a skill, you're not actively thinking about a topic, you're not being creative. It's really, you're really robbing yourself of the rich variety of what your experience as a student and life in general could be. If we are too passive by in allowing big tech companies, and big or small tech companies to give us products and we're supposed to use them, and we don't participate, well, whether in the development of those, and we don't sort of remember that there's also other aspects of life that have nothing to do with technology. Again, I'm a cautious optimist. I like my technology, and I use it every day like everyone else. And most of the technology we use are means to other ends. This, of course, is a very basic distinction, but we have to think about which things in life are mere means to other ends, and which things do we think are worth pursuing or doing for their own sakes. And sometimes it's a little bit surprising, because, of course, you want certain things as the goal at the end of your, you know, you're working really hard to achieve something. But a lot of the time, actually, the process of doing something, the process of creating art, as you start learning to think and write and create art, the products that you produce at the beginning may not be very good, but it's very fulfilling to improve, to become better. It's a skill to learn, to see your progress, and to also be among others who are also trying to learn similar skills and to make similar progress. If everything in life is reduced to the means to other ends, but you're never really focusing on what are my ends, what are my goals, which things do I value for their own sake, then I think we're living in a sort of impoverished, not very rich type of life.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.